Numbers chapter 31. This is a long chapter, but we're concerned only with the first section of it today. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. Afterward shalt thou be gathered unto thy people. Now this fulfills a word that God spoke to Moses earlier on in chapter 25 at verse 17. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Vex the Midianites and smite them, for they vex you with their wiles, wherewith they have beguiled you in the matter of Peor, in the matter of Cosbi, the daughter of a prince of Midian, their sister, which was slain in the day of the plague for Peor's sake. And this is the fulfillment of it. Avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. Afterward shalt thou be gathered unto thy people. That is to say, this is the last action, the last commitment given to Moses as the leader of the people of God. And then he was to be gathered home to his fathers. And Moses spake unto the people, saying, Arm some of yourselves unto the war, and let them go against the Midianites, and avenge the Lord of Midian. Of every tribe 1,000, throughout all the tribes of Israel, shall ye send to the war. So there were delivered out of the thousands of Israel 1,000 of every tribe, 12,000 armed for war. So obviously this was a restricted operation. And Moses sent them to the war, 1,000 of every tribe, them and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, to the war with the holy instruments and the trumpets to blow in his hand. And they warred against the Midianites, as the Lord commanded Moses, and they slew all the males. And they slew the kings of Midian, beside the rest of them that were slain, namely Evi, and Rechem, and Zur, and Hur, and Reba, 5 kings of Midian. Balaam also, the son of Beor, they slew with the sword. This Balaam, who had wrought such havoc in Israel by teaching the Moabites how to corrupt Israel, and he had sought refuge, doubtless, and a pleasant, as he thought, anonymity in the ranks of Midian. But you see, God always gets his man. And however deeply you may hide in the ranks of Midian, God finds you out when you've done wrong, as Balaam proved this day to his cost. Balaam also, the son of Beor, they slew with the sword. And the children of Israel took all the women of Midian captives, and their little ones, and took the spoil of all their cattle, and all their flocks, and all their goods. And they burned all their cities wherein they dwelt, and all their goodly castles, with fire. And they took all the spoil, and all the prey, both of men and of beasts. And they brought the captives, and the prey, and the spoil, unto Moses, and Eleazar the priest, and unto the congregation of the children of Israel, unto the camp at the plains of Moab, which are by Jordan near Jericho. And Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the princes of the congregation went forth to meet them without the camp. And Moses was wroth with the officers of the host, with the captains over thousands and captains over hundreds, which came from the battle. And Moses said unto them, Have you saved all the women alive? Behold, these caused the children of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to commit trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that hath known man by lying with him. But all the women children that have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. And do ye abide without the camp 7 days. Whosoever hath killed any person, and whosoever hath touched any slain, purify both yourselves and your captives on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. And purify all your raiment, and all that is made of skins, and all the work of goat's hair, and all the things made of wood. And Eleazar the priest said unto the men of war which went to the battle, This is the ordinance of the law which the Lord commanded Moses. Only the gold and the silver, the brass, the iron, the tin and the lead, everything that may abide the fire, ye shall make it go through the fire, and it shall be clean. Nevertheless, it shall be purified with the water of separation, and all that abideth not the fire, ye shall make go through the water. And ye shall wash your clothes on the seventh day, and ye shall be clean, and afterward ye shall come into the camp. And the remainder of the chapter deals with the apportionment of the spoils of this war. And it was divided in strict apportionment between the congregation of Israel and the warriors who went out. Amen. May God bless to us the reading of His holy word. Now let us turn together to Numbers chapter 31. The war against the Midianites. Now this war against the Midianites is clearly meant to be understood as a holy war. That is to say, it was a war ordained by God to be a judgment and a punishment upon Midian because of Midian's sins. And unless we grasp this fundamental reality, we'll not really see the meaning and the significance of the chapter, which is undoubtedly one that presents very real moral difficulties to our minds. The story is quite straightforward. Moses is commanded by God to avenge Israel upon Midian. And as I quoted from chapter 25, this was in relation to the disastrous beguiling of the people of Israel under the influence of Balaam. And as we noticed, significantly, Balaam was slain in this battle. A small army was selected that went out against Midian, devastated it, slayed its five kings, destroyed its cities, and took an enormous amount of booty captive, concerning the apportionment of which the rest of the chapter is devoted. On the return with the booty, Moses expostulated very angrily with the captains of the host at the sight of the women that they had taken captive, and commanded that all save those who were innocent girls should be slain, including all male children. This was done at the command of Moses, who in turn had sent the children of Israel on this war at the command of the Lord. Now it's this last part particularly that raises all sorts of questions, anxious questions in our minds. And I don't think it would be honest of us or honorable to pass these questions by without saying something about them, without trying to justify them or to explain them in some way. And so, not without considerable misgiving, I want you to think about these matters with me now. First of all, could I say a general word about the grim and sometimes gruesome accounts that we see in, particularly in the earlier books of the Old Testament, about the slaughter perpetrated on the nations of Canaan by the Israelites. One after the other, these nations of Canaan, the Hivites, the Gergesites, the Jebusites, and so on, were devastated by Israel. Now, what we must understand clearly, and this of course includes within it the story here about Midian, is that these were holy wars. And they were commanded by God. And the only way to make sense of these bloody carnages, and they were very bloody at times, and the only way to see any moral ground for Israel displacing these nations of Canaan from their land in Canaan is to realize that God was using them, using Israel as the rod of his anger against them, judging them for their sins and for their depravities. Now, this is the explanation that the Old Testament itself gives, by implication and often quite explicitly, concerning these devastating wars. I want you to look at two verses in particular which seem to me to underline this. In Genesis chapter 15, at verse 16, this is an excerpt from the story of Abraham, and God is telling him, as it were, in vision, what is to happen to his posterity, the third and fourth generation, and later on. Let's read from verse 13. And God said unto Abraham, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge. This is referring, of course, to Egypt. And afterward they shall come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again. Hither meaning Canaan, where Abraham was standing at this precise moment. In the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Now there's a whole philosophy in this last phrase. And what God is saying is this. The Amorites are going to be displaced from their land, and your posterity, Abraham, is going to take their place. But this is not happening just yet, because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. The day will come when they will go beyond the pale, when they will go over the score. But so far, that day hasn't come, and I'm being patient with them, says the Lord. That's the first verse. Now, in Leviticus chapter 18, we see a similar reference. Leviticus chapter 18, and here we have some injunctions given by Moses from the Lord to the children of Israel. And at verse 24, this is what he says, Defile not ye yourselves in any of these things. And if we had time to read chapter 18, we would see the prohibitions against some horrid and unnatural sins and vices. And this is what God says, Defile not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all these things the nations are defiled, which I cast out, which I am going to cast out before you. And the land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgment, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you. For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled, that the land spew not you out also when ye defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. For whosoever shall commit any of these abominations, even the souls that commit them, shall be cut off from among the people. Therefore ye shall keep mine ordinance, that ye commit not any one of these abominations which were committed before you, and that ye defile not yourselves therein. I am the Lord your God. Now that's a clear statement of the reasons why God is casting out the Hivites and the Amorites and the Gergesites and the Jebusites and all these nations. It was because of the utter depravity of their way of life. They had gone from bad to worse, and archaeological research and ancient history research goes to substantiate that these nations lived in indescribable, blasphemous degradation. And it was for this reason that God used his own people as the rod of his anger against these nations to drive them out. And when Israel finally moved into Canaan, it was, of course, God giving them, according to his promise, this land. But it was also, at the same time, God sending judgment upon these nations, because the cup of his indignation concerning them was full. The iniquity of the Canaanite nations was full, and the time of their destruction was ripe. And this is why they were thus dealt with. It was no arbitrary act of injustice. And this is sometimes forgotten. Sometimes it's said, God put Israel into Canaan unjustly. No, no, no. These nations had forfeited the right to live as nations by the extremes of their debauchery. Just as earlier on, Sodom and Gomorrah had forfeited the right to exist any further as cities and were destroyed. And further back still, just as the Canaanite civilization had forfeited all right to continue living. And so God sent the judgment of the flood. And you'll remember that God dealt with his own people in precisely the same way. When they fell into debauchery and depravity and idolatry, he sent prophets to warn them what he would do, reminding them what he had done to the heathen nations because they had gone like that, and saying, if you go like that, the same fate will follow you. They didn't believe him. But God kept his word, and they were taken into captivity for the 70 years of exile in Babylon. And to understand God's burning passion for righteousness in his creatures is to understand the basic reason for these judgments upon men and nations that refused to be righteous and that rendered themselves incapable of being righteous by their continuance in sin. And what we must recognize is not the arbitrary way in which God acts here, but the patience that he shows with these nations. He shows long patience with them before he finally brings them into judgment. Now, that's the first point, and that, it seems to me, is the general lesson that the scriptures teach us concerning God's dealings with these nations. And unless this is true, then there can be no kind of justification whatever for the terrible carnages and slaughters that took place in Old Testament's times. But if this is the motivating principle, then everything else seems to fall into perspective. And we see that Israel is being used by God as the rod of his anger. That's the first point. And the second is this, concerning Midian. Midian was an implacable enemy of Israel right down her history. And at that time, Midian constituted a threat to Israel's very existence as a spiritual people. Balaam had shown the way to corrupt them. And the ugly incidents that are recorded in chapter 25, if we had time to read them, are enough to show just what a demoralizing power this had become in the life of Israel. Now, to understand this fully, we've got to bear in mind the overall strategy of God in his dealings with his people, choosing Israel and bringing them into the land. Redemption, world redemption, you see, was the culminating concern, and the production of the promised seed who was to be the savior of the world. And of course, and this is the point, the corrupting influence of Midian was threatening the very existence of the line of promise. This is the real issue. Israel was in danger.
of being so completely corrupted that any further dealings on God's part with his people would have been out of the question. And therefore, since this was so, Midian had to be exterminated. Now, this is the understanding of this chapter. And this is why we must necessarily affirm that this word at the beginning of the chapter, "The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites," is in fact the simple truth. This is something that God did. And it begs the question for any of us to say, "Oh, but this was just a misunderstanding that Moses had of God's will. God would never do a thing like this." Nothing of the sort. God said this, and on the biblical understanding of itself, this is precisely the interpretation and the only interpretation that makes sense. But it does make sense. Here then is the people of God, whom God has taken up, and who over the centuries was to be so disciplined by God and handled by God that in the fullness of the time, from this nation there would come the promised seed, the world redeemer. And right in the very heart of this long process of preparation, there comes this tremendous danger, this peril that was threatening the very existence of the line of promise. God couldn't do anything else. God had to deal with it. It was as critical as that. That's the second point. But we go on to say this. What are we to say about the harsh barbarities committed, and particularly the slaughter of the women and the children? Well, the usual answer that is given here by, alas, too many, is simply to say that, of course, a good deal of the Old Testament is sub-Christian, and we could never hold with many of the things like this that are written in the history books of the Old Testament and in the Psalms. These were primitive times, and they didn't know any better. Now, that's a very widespread interpretation of the Old Testament. But this is not only too simple a conclusion to come to, it's also a silly one, as a moment or two's reflection will make plain. And of course it raises far more serious questions and problems than it would ever solve. But you see what's happening. The moment you say this, you're cutting out whole portions of the scriptures and saying, "These are not inspired by God. That's not inspired by God." But when you say that, you're making your own moral judgment the criterion of what is inspired and what is not. In other words, the scriptures no longer have an objective validity. Only that is inspired which you consider to be inspired. Now that's a very dangerous ground to take. That's claiming inspiration for yourself, you see, which is scarcely an improvement. And of course another man may apply his judgment in other directions. He may see something in a passage that you perhaps accept as inspired, and you'll say, "Oh no, that's not inspired. I can't accept that as inspired. I don't think God would do a thing like that." And before you know where you are, your Bible's a thing of shreds and patches. You've no longer got an inspired Bible. You've got a Bible that's emasculated. And of course, that's precisely what does happen when you take this kind of attitude and say, "Of course, this can't be inspired." And I think we should see that what we in fact are doing, if we say that, is to raise up our own moral judgment as the sole criterion.
we are deciding what is inspired and what is not. And of course, this is a vicious circle. Where have we got our knowledge of what is inspired or not? But that kind of attitude is highly unsatisfactory for quite other reasons also. For one thing, the idea that this, and I'm referring to the chapter now, that this took place in primitive times when moral sense was at a low ebb and that they didn't know any better, is plainly at variance with the testimony of the chapter itself. For it was not the people who initiated this slaughter. If it had been, then we might see the force of such a charge. For the people were, as we know, a pretty dubious lot, with much that was unlovely about their character as a whole. But it was precisely not the people. It was Moses who said, "Kill the children." The people spared them. It was Moses, the man of God, who said, "Slay the male children." And Moses walked with God. He was the spiritual giant among them, with whom God spake face to face. Clearly, if it had simply been the expression of a primitive and savage brutality on the part of a backward people who didn't know any better, the story would have read the other way round. And what you would have had would be something like this. They would have been busy slaying the people, and Moses would have strode amongst them and said, "Stop this senseless barbarity. This crude and evil thing. Stop killing the poor children." But you see, it's the opposite way around. Had we not thought of that? It's he who protests against sparing them. And obviously there must be something far more in this story than any simple dismissal of it by saying that, of course, these were primitive times and they didn't know any better. And as for saying that they didn't know any better, that also is at variance with the facts. You've only to read prior to the book of Numbers and earlier on in the book of Numbers and in Exodus. Read some of the legislation that God had given through Moses to this people. And you become amazed at the tenderness that was expressed in it. Listen to this. Exodus chapter 22. Listen to these words. "Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword." You see the tenderness of the heart of God towards the defenseless, towards children, towards widows. Now, if we'd time, we could go right through the book of Leviticus and see this compassionate legislation. It's simply not true to say that they didn't know any better. Of course they knew. And obviously, this means that there's something else lying at the root of it. And the something else is what I've been trying to explain earlier on, that this is a holy war, and that this is done at the command and behest of God. Moses was not acting in a barbarous manner. You cannot square his conduct here with the other scriptures on this thesis. What he was doing, and I believe what he was conscious of doing, was acting as the theocratic leader of the people. That is to say, acting as a legal judge in relation to the Midianites.
and as an executor of divine justice. This is the truth of the position. And we must understand this. You see, there were no courts of law as such in Moses' day. There was no international court of the Hague in Moses' time to which disputes among nations could be brought. No recognized outside authority. But justice, you see, was administered for all that. And it was administered through Moses, the God-appointed leader of the people. And we must recognize that it was never a case of taking the law into his own hands when Moses decided on this or that course of action. For he habitually acted as the Lord's representative and spokesman. Now we must recognize this validity, the validity of this in the Old Testament times. Moses and the elders of Israel were equivalent in that sense to courts of law, high courts, sheriff courts as we know them today. And high courts and sheriff courts and the legal court of the House of Lords are direct descendants of this theocratic idea. We must recognize this to be so. And consequently, Moses is absolved from all charge of simply taking the law into his own hands. Read in one sense, of course, it looks as if he is taking law in his own hands. But if you recognize that he is the appointed judge of Israel, then he is not taking law into his own hands. So far then, so good. But we might say, well, pretty grim justice. Yes, perhaps. But what I've already said about the heathen nations helps to explain why such grim justice was so necessary. And in this connection, there's another consideration, and it's this. We must bear in mind that Israel was in a particular situation at this time. They were an emergent people in the sense that they were about to come into their own as the people of God with a destiny, with a calling in the world, in the land of Canaan. This is what they were called for. They were called to be a peculiar people in the land of Canaan for God, that in the fullness of the time they might be a light to lighten the Gentiles. And always, in emergent nations, you will necessarily find a certain stringency in its disciplines that you do not find in mere static or degenerating national situations. And this, you see, explains why, for example, in Exodus chapter 21 and 22, you find the death penalty being ordained and sometimes applied for crimes other than murder, breaking the Sabbath, adultery, and so on. Now, bear in mind that it's not so very long ago in our own legislature that adultery, as well as being a sin, was a crime that you could be put in prison for. It's not on the statute book now as a crime, but it used to be. And this just reminds us that law evolves in the passage of time. But my point is this. Crimes other than murder were punishable by death. And this is at least in part due to the fact that Israel was an emergent nation, and therefore extremely strict disciplines were necessary for her very existence and continued existence as an emergent nation. And very significantly, and we dealt with this some months ago when we were dealing with this matter in the book of Exodus. Very significantly, you find that in the emergent nations of the 20th century, you have a similar pattern. You can have the death penalty in Russia today, not only for murder, but for defrauding the people. And there was a case reported, was it last year, about a man who had fraudulently deceived the factory in which he worked over a period of years, sentenced to death for defrauding the people. Now, you don't get a death sentence in this country for fraud. You do in Russia. And you do in China. For this reason, that these are emergent nations with very much stricter disciplines. And this, of course, in part at least, explains the fact that immorality is dealt with very much more severely in Russia and in China than in London and in Edinburgh. What we do in this country is to say something like this. This is a tragic factor in our society. We cannot deal with it. Therefore, let us legalize some of it, at least. That's how we deal with prostitution in this country. But that's not how they deal with it in Russia or in China. There is almost no venereal disease in Russia today, when Britain's nearly rotten with it. For this reason, Russia has applied stringent disciplines. China has wiped prostitution out of her cities. There is virtually no prostitution in Peking. Whereas you can't walk a dozen steps in the West End of London without being accosted. There is the difference between the two kinds of nation. There is the stringency of discipline in an emergent nation. Now this explains the stringency and the severity of the disciplines that were applied in order to keep the people pure and clean. Now you find precisely the same in the New Testament, in the Acts of the Apostles. When the New Testament church was forging ahead in all its spiritual power and grace, a grave peril entered into it in the shape of Ananias and Sapphira. Two believers who became hypocritical and untrue to the highest. And God judged them with death. The hand of the Lord came upon them. And they died. Now, people have done this kind of thing since. They haven't died, except in the spiritual sense. They still go on living. God doesn't deal with people like that generally today. But he did then, and for this reason, that the very life and existence of the early church depended upon a grim, almost, and stringent discipline being applied. It had to be kept pure. That danger, if it had been left unchecked, would have spread like a poison throughout the early church. With a little baby, there are certain very strict measures that the medical profession will take concerning infection. Because you see, that life is so precious, they can't afford to run the risk of anything touching it.
And in that sense, the medical profession may err on the safe side. Fair enough. That's how God does. It may be even that he erred on the safe side in this stringent dealing with Midian.
Well, it seems to me that that answers a great many questions, but there is still the question, the little children, God said, kill them. Can it be? Did God ordain this? Well, one recognizes that there are problems and questions in the scriptures that we must simply bow before. And the words of the hymn have a real application here. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. And I believe the proper attitude confronted with this kind of situation is not to say, oh, God couldn't have said that. Because the Bible says God did. And the moment you say he couldn't have, you're into other problems. The correct attitude, I believe, is to say, well, I can't understand why this should be. But I'm prepared to believe that God did so in righteousness. Now, may I say one or two things in this connection? First of all, we must notice that it was not a question of mere wanton brutality, and it was not indiscriminate. Not all children were slain, the males. You see, as soon as you begin to examine the situation dispassionately and logically and critically, rather than emotionally, you begin to see all sorts of things that you didn't see before. This is no question of an indiscriminate slaughter of children by an angry prophet. No, no. The males, not the females. And the significance of that is this. They were the future Midian and a potential danger and peril for Israel if they'd been allowed to grow up. This is the point. What we must remember in this connection is that there is such a thing as a national character and national traits and propensities. We speak of such and such a nation being naturally a military people and liable to do warlike and belligerent deeds. We've known that to our cost in the 20th century with Germany. A warlike people, and we may not even yet have heard the end of it. And so it was with the Midianites. And we must bear in mind also something that is near our own time. We've seen the extirpation of whole cities during the Second World War by the great 1,000 bomber raids on Germany, when undoubtedly many women and children were slaughtered. And rightly or wrongly, we estimated that the only way for the German menace to be destroyed was to have done this, when doing this involved many innocent people. This is part of the tragedy and paradox of war. But when the last is said, I think we're still faced with problems here that we must bow humbly before and believe that the judge of all the earth does right. But I think that's not the last word. I think the last word is this. We must remember that these things are written for our learning and admonition. And the whole literal history of God's people in their journeyings from Egypt to Canaan are, we are told in the New Testament, a pattern, an illustration, a type of the Christian life and the Christian pilgrimage. And therefore, there are lessons here for us. And aside altogether from the concern to justify the ways of God to men, we can go too far in that direction. God giveth not account of any of his matters. Aside altogether from that attitude, we can see something here of very real import. Let us suppose
that Moses' point in slaying the male children was that they were, in fact, a potential future menace, and that then was the time for them to be dealt with. C.S. Lewis allegorizes some of the Psalms in his book Reflection on the Psalms in this way, speaking of the destruction of little children. And this is what he says. This has helped me and it will help you. I know things in the inner world of the spirit which are like babies, the infantile beginnings of small indulgences, small resentments, which may one day become dipsomania or settled hatred, but which woo us and wheedle us with special pleadings and seem so tiny and so helpless that in resisting them we feel we're being cruel to animals. And he says, in the spiritual sense, kill them. Show them no mercy, for they will grow and rend you and perhaps destroy you. Now, if this is a parable and pattern of spiritual life, it's not difficult for us to see that this is the value for us here. And from this we must learn to resist beginnings in temptation. We dabble with them. They seem so harmless. They seem so little. They seem powerless in our hands. They wheedle us, as Lewis says, with special pleadings, and they woo us. They seem so tiny and helpless. Kill them. Kill them when they're young. How many of us today could stand up with bitter regret and tears and tell a story like this and say, this thing that has destroyed my spiritual life and usefulness began as a little thing in my experience. I entertained it. I played with it. I saw no harm in it. It was harmless. It was such a little thing. I indulged it. I spared it. And it grew up and killed me. My dear friends, let us remember that the little things are very often the things that grow in our lives until they throttle us and strangle us and make us useless for God. They're such pretty things. They're so attractive. They've got a fascination, just like a baby has a fascination. You know how we could play with a baby all day long.